Second case on today's oral argument calendar is Storland and Others versus Nordic Townhomes Limited Partnership, number A18-1564. We have, for the appellants, I'm looking at the list of cases. I believe we have one appellant who's filed a brief, and that's the partnership itself, correct?
Correct.
And three respondents, Storland, Rustin, and Anderson, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. As you know, you each have 15 minutes for your principal argument, and appellant has an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal. Appellant's counsel, you may approach and begin. Please identify yourself at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. May it please the court and counsel, my name is Anthony Gabor, and I'm here today representing the appellants in this case, or the appellant who's filed the brief, the limited partnership. And Your Honor, the reason we're here is because respondents brought an action in Dakota County District Court, and they sought an order for that court to wind up the business of the limited partnership. And it's undisputed that those respondents were not and never were partners of the limited partnership. Instead, they collectively held a 33 1/3 interest that had been transferred to them a couple of times. Their father had originally been a limited partner of the partnership and had transferred his interest to his wife upon his death. She did not become a partner, and they purchased, the children purchased the interest from Norma Storland. They also did not become a partner. That's not in dispute. We brought a summary judgment
motion.
But
they do have an interest. How would you describe that interest if it's not a partnership interest? I mean,
I would describe it similar to how the partnership agreement describes it. They have a financial interest. The only right that they have under the partnership agreement is to distributions and payouts that come from the partnership. They have no voting rights. They have no rights that a partner would have other than a financial interest. To the extent the partnership makes money, they will get a distribution when the partnership makes distributions. And in fact, the partnership has been making distributions to them and everyone else that has a financial interest. It's been nominal, Your Honors. It's only $250 a month.
But if, let's say that distribution wasn't made, wouldn't they, as transferees, that's kind of the way I think of them,
right,
be able to go into court and say, look, they're not following the partnership agreement. They owe us money, and they're not giving it to us. Wouldn't they be able to do that?
They could. They wouldn't have standing. They could make the argument that, and this is referenced in the district court's order in this case, in the Gale versus Rittenhouse case that I rely heavily on in my brief. The district court there said that a non-partner could come in and say to a court, hey, the partners are not following the partnership agreement. And what the district court, Ramsey County, said in that case is they could argue that that limits the liability of the, or I take that back, it removes any limitation on liability of the partners for not following the partnership agreement, but the district court there specifically said that would not cause a dissolution or a windup.
But that was because, wasn't that because the district court said, look, your interest is going to be decided in arbitration, so isn't that really a different case?
It's not a different case because in that case, Gail was looking for, she looked for two things. She wanted an order to wind up the business based upon the very same argument that respondents are making now, that there was some terminating event that happened and that she's entitled to 50% of the business. And with the district court there.
And she had agreed to arbitration to deal with
correct,
what that interest was.
But I think the difference there is she was actually a signatory and a party to that agreement. So as a former general partner, what we have here are people, transferees, who have only a financial interest. They were never part of this agreement. They received it by just purchasing their mother's interest.
When you say only a financial interest, I mean it's equity, right? It's property. It has value.
It does. But just because they are the beneficiaries of something that their father had done, I mean, arguably he had put in money and he was a limited partner and he had created this equity, this was something they inherited. So it's nothing that basically fell into their laps. So to the extent...
Well, no, they paid money to their mother to acquire it, right?
They did.
Okay, so they paid $80,000 to acquire this, asset.
But, Your Honor, they knew that they were getting when they purchased it. I mean, arguably, they had a copy of the partnership agreement in front of them, and they knew that by taking over this interest, they would have no rights.
Well, when they made that acquisition, were one or two of the original limited partners still alive?
I believe they were.
Okay. So they could read the partnership agreement, and they could foresee what their what they would get in the future upon the deaths of those two people?
They could.
So, counsel, I mean, I look at the complaint in this matter. Nowhere do they cite Minnesota Statute 321.0802 dealing with judicial dissolutions. I read this as saying more like, enforce the partnership agreement.
And, Your Honor, they don't cite it, if you mean cite it, by telling you this is the statute we're citing it from. They cite to part of it when they say that it's not reasonably practicable to continue the business activities. That is part of the second half of the statute, where it basically says that a partner may apply to the district court, and the district court may order the dissolution if it's not reasonably practicable to continue the activities of the partnership in conformity with the partnership agreement.
And that language is not in 0801.
That's in 0802.
Right.
Correct. So I guess getting back to the whole reason we're here, our argument here is that the respondents do not have standing to bring this type of argument. And we rely heavily on we think the district court erred when it said there is nothing that has been presented that said that the plaintiff's interests were not to be protected.
Who has standing under 0801?
0801 is the partnership. Well, it's not the transferees because they just don't have standing.
Who does have standing?
A partner would have standing to argue that something has happened here.
Well, assume there's no longer a partner. Who has standing to dissolve, to involve the court in dissolving a partnership under 0801?
I think if there were no partners left at all, meaning limited and general partners, which is not the case in our case, then at that point, somebody with a financial interest could have standing to basically make the court aware. Or if there was no partners left, I don't know that you'd even need court involvement, because you could get together and agree or not agree as to what was going to happen with the partnership with anyone that had a financial interest. So I don't know that you'd need court involvement at all under 801.
Well, isn't the point, I think, that the respondents here are trying to make is you shouldn't have needed court involvement because it should have just dissolved pursuant to the partnership agreement. I mean, let me put it this way. The way I'm reading this, and you know this better than I do, so correct me where you think I'm wrong, is that in general, partnership agreements, limited partnerships agreements, should address how they'll be dissolved. And that's a non-judicial, and they should be addressed in the partnership agreement. But there may be circumstances where they should be able to be dissolved even not in accordance with the partnership agreement. And if you're going to do that, you have to be a partner and be able to go to court to do it. And that's how we get to 0802. So it's a subset of dissolutions. I may have made that question too complicated.
So you're saying besides what's in 0801, 0802 is in addition to that. Is that the statement you're making?
So that there's the part in general, the partnership agreement sets out when and how it should be dissolved.
Correct.
But the way I read 0802 is, but if a partner thinks a limited partnership should be dissolved because it's not able to continue with the activities of the limited partnership in conformity with the partnership agreement. So in other words, there's something that needs to be done that's not in conformity with the partnership agreement.
Right.
Then the partner goes to court. Because otherwise, you need to follow the partnership agreement.
Well, I think if you look at the very beginning language of 0802, mm-hmm. I'm sorry, 0801, where it says, except as otherwise stated, in 08-02, here's how the partnership agreement, here's what happens under the partnership agreement. Okay, so there's some language there that says, hey, except for what we say over here, here's how it's going to happen. So if you look at 08-02, a partner may decide that it's not reasonably practicable to continue the business operations under the conformity of the partnership agreement. So our position is that you've got to look to 08-02 first to decide whether a partner is going to move to dissolve the company.
But by its terms, 08-01 is the exception to 08-02.
Correct. Correct. So you look, and if you look at 08-02, a partner must do that. And if you look at the Gale case, if you look at what Gale asked for in her complaint, she asked for a declaratory judgment to determine that the partnership was dissolved, terminated, and had to end. And her basis for that was that she claimed a terminating event had happened. And this court had said, well, that language is ambiguous as to whether she's asking for a judicial dissolution or a non-judicial dissolution. And they ended up affirming the district court, who interpreted that as seeking a judicial dissolution. The language here has no ambiguity. Respondents here are not seeking a declaratory judgment. They asked this court to order the business to be wound up.
Well, didn't they really bring an action to enforce paragraph 17.2F?
Yes, but they went about it the wrong way, as the district court in Gale said. The only thing a non-partner can do in a situation like this is to say, hey, the partners are not following that agreement.
So you would agree that if they'd gone into court and asked for a declaratory judgment action to declare that the partnership should be dissolved as a matter of law according to the partnership agreement, that they would have standing to do that?
Not under Gale, Your Honor, because that's what Gale did. Gale asked for a declaratory judgment action, and this court said she doesn't have standing because she's not a partner at the time that she brought the action. She's a former general partner. Right. And the only thing she has a right to is arbitration to determine the price of her shares. And here we've got respondents who were never partners. We're not even dealing with a former partner. They were never partners. So if a former partner in their complaint asserts what this court determined to be ambiguous language, doesn't have standing, then our position is the respondents here absolutely don't have standing because their language is not ambiguous.
So, bottom line, though, it troubles me that we have a partnership agreement that I'm reading it pretty clearly says it should be canceled, dissolved by now because all the limited partners are dead. And you're telling me that no one can enforce that.
No one can enforce it because it's subject to 08-02. And there's a general partner that's still alive, and the business continued to run. It continued to make money. It did not, as you know, the respondents asserted in their complaint, that the benefits to the people with a financial interest were outweighed by the costs for running the business. And in the record, we indicated to the district court that's not what happened here.
We have limited partners when they made this agreement that probably may have wanted, after their deaths, the asset to be able to be passed along to their children, and that can't be enforced, that intent, stated in the partnership agreement.
What is clearly stated in the partnership agreement?
That the cancellation of the certificate of limited partnership or if all of the limited partners cease to be such, that then the partnership will be liquidated and dissolved.
Well, but that doesn't say that the partners wanted that to pass on to their children and to them to benefit from that. The partnership agreement, what the purpose of the agreement is to purchase and sell property and make money for the partnership. That is still happening, or that was still happening. The partnership was making not a lot of money, but money, and it was profitable. And there was a general partner who was still running it. And while the people who have a financial interest here, the respondents, could have brought a claim to say, not following the agreement, we can hold him liable any partners liable for whatever damages we suffer as a result of him not following the agreement. The district court in Gale said that does not result in a termination or dissolution of the partnership because they don't have standing to do it.
And so I know you haven't appealed the merits, but I mean, the district court also found that paragraph 17.2F was triggered. Was that in error? I know you're not appealing that. You're just trying to cut him off at the pass and challenge standing. But I mean, can you tell us whether under the terms of 17.2F, it seems to me like the partnership must be dissolved. Do you disagree?
That's what the partnership agreement says. We're not disputing the language of the partnership agreement or that finding. We're just saying that these parties don't have standing to seek the dissolution of the partnership. And the only thing they have standing to do is to bring suit against the remaining partner or had to say, hey, you're not following the partnership agreement. Here are the damages that we're suffering because you're not following the partnership agreement.
So
the legal remedy for that.
So paragraph 13.3 talks about a transfer to a person who is not a partner. And, you know, if they're not accepted into the partnership, they still are entitled to a pro rata share of partnership income, gains, losses, credits, deductions, and distributions as are otherwise made available in accordance with this agreement. It seems to me that the way to get a distribution is one way is to have the partnership dissolved. But so even though they're not a partner, they have a right to the financial benefits that are provided by the agreement. Isn't that a basis for standing right there?
No, because they're not a partner. That's all they have a right to, and they've been receiving that.
But the partnership agreement says even though they're not a partner, they're entitled to those aspects of, you know, the financial benefits of being a partnership unit.
Yes, and they've received those, and they got
those. But not the distributions.
There were monthly distributions made of $250, and they received those every month.
Well, or would that be dividends?
It's
not distribution of capital, right? The monthly payments are a share of profits from ongoing operations.
That's correct, and it's arguably a small amount, but they would be sent out to everybody every month. So they are getting and received everything that they were entitled to under the partnership agreement.
Am I correct? There's a provision in the partnership agreement. I don't have it in front of me that says this partnership agreement shall terminate in 2025?
That's correct.
Okay, so what if it doesn't? And so we're in 2026. Is there anybody who can enforce that?
I think that the same thing would happen then that I'm arguing should have happened now, where somebody with a financial interest, a transferee, could come into district court and say there's a breach of the contract. He's not enforcing the terms. The general partners are not enforcing the terms. We are, if they can come up with some damages because of that.
Well, but wouldn't you be making the same argument then? I mean,
that's different from dissolving. It's different from dissolving the partnership, because if the people of the financial interest were successful on a claim that I just mentioned, they'd be entitled to monetary damages, arguably from the individual partner. And if the individual partner decided, okay, I'm going to pay you the damages that the court ordered me to pay you, then could arguably continue running the partnership after that, and it wouldn't terminate. So I think the respondents here did have a remedy. They didn't pursue it, but they don't have standing to come into district court and say that this partnership should be terminated.
And I don't see why that same reasoning then could not be used in 2025 to deny dissolution at that time.
I think the argument would be the same in terms of what the respondents would argue is now, because of the issue is different. It terminates based on the time frame, and if they are suffering damages.
You say if, but so nobody has just an absolute right to enforce that clear end date.
It's not nobody. It's just non-partners don't have the right to enforce any provision that calls for a termination of the partnership agreement.
You're making me concerned that if we were to grant you relief and affirm, it would be effectively, you know, allowing this partnership to exist in perpetuity.
Well, the partnership agreement can always be amended to go on beyond 2025. I guess it depends upon how the partnership is doing in 2025, if there are additional partners that have been added that want to continue it. So there's a lot that can happen in the next 6 years that can determine whether or not the partnership actually does terminate. So I think we're speculating a little bit, but I understand the court's point. And I guess my point is that in a situation like this, the people with a financial interest have a remedy. They can seek damages from the individual partner for not following the partnership agreement, but can't seek the remedy of dissolution from the district court based on a lack of standing.
We've gone over time, but you will have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondents.
Thank you, Your Honor. Joseph Schmidt appearing for the respondents, plaintiffs, Your Honors, fellow counsel. So my position has been pretty simple. It is basically that the agreement provides for a liquidation at this point. There are no limited partners. My clients are the only persons that have a financial, and those similarly situated, that have a financial interest that's at stake in the matter. So we have standing to enforce the terms of the agreement. One of the things I think that gets a little bit confusing, that makes the issues confusing, is the use of the word dissolution, termination, liquidation, et cetera. The statute 0801 talks about non-judicial dissolution. So non-judicial dissolution obviously is talking about not having a court involved making a determination. It's something that happens upon the occurrence of an event, the way I understand it.
So, but if it doesn't happen, presumably there's a declaratory judgment action. If it doesn't happen without court involvement, presumably in order for it to happen, there has to be some declaratory judgment action.
Well, I think the liquidation might have to require that, but the dissolution, I think, happens upon the trigger event. So if the way the statute says, basically, that the dissolution occurs upon the happening of any of these following events. So I think, I don't want to get too metaphysical about it, but I think dissolution occurs, and the result of that is that the obligation of the general partner is then to liquidate, that is, put the assets up for sale. He doesn't have authority anymore to continue to run the business. So it happens, and our action was one for liquidation. The events which occurred, which we allege, namely that there are no more limited partners, had occurred, and thus the partnership dissolves, and we sought a liquidation. Counsel, to sort of illustrate the confusion, he casts our claim as one seeking judicial dissolution of the partnership. The event has already occurred. We're not asking that it be dissolved under 0802. We're saying, you know, the event causing dissolution has happened, now liquidate. And I don't want to make it confusing, but I just think that those terms get thrown around like they're the same. Dissolution and liquidation are not the same.
So your position is that it's not appropriate to infer that the claim was based on 0802, despite the fact that the operative language of 0802 is what was used as the trigger, practical.
I threw that in the complaint, and if I had it to do over again, I wouldn't put that in there. You know, when you're drafting a complaint, you put in everything that you think might be relevant. That would have been a fact issue and would have required a trial to determine whether it was, in fact, reasonably practical. But that's not the way the decision of the district court was made, or that's not what I'm arguing for now. I'm stating that there isn't any question that the triggering event of dissolution occurred, namely all the limited partners died. The agreement requires dissolution at that point, and my clients are the ones who are affected by that. If you look also at 3210702, which deals with the transferee's rights, so under paragraph B 2, it states that upon the dissolution and winding up of the limited partnership activities, the net amount is due the transferee, which was otherwise distributed to the transferor. So my clients as transferees under the statute are entitled to the net amount that would have been distributable to a limited partnership upon winding up. So, and it states at the first part of that, a transferee has a right to receive, in accordance with the transfer, the net amount that's due upon dissolution and winding up. So, again, not to make it too confusing, but under the statute and also under the agreement, my clients are entitled to distributions. Those distributions include amounts that are payable upon liquidation, and all the events have occurred requiring liquidation. Therefore, they have been damaged by the general's refusal to liquidate.
So do I understand, just to clarify that, the district court did not grant you the relief that you requested?
No, I'm sorry. I must be not making myself clear.
No, I'm sorry.
Yes, they did grant the relief, namely that the partnership be liquidated. So, yes.
Well, I mean, the order says the court hereby orders that Nordic be dissolved.
Yes, I
realize. I noticed in your complaint, in the wherefore clause, you don't use the word dissolved.
Right, right. I mean, I think that the use of the word dissolve is not appropriate. I mean, I think it's already dissolved. The event of dissolution has occurred. So what we're seeking, of course, is liquidation. But I don't think it matters in terms of the effect of the order is the same.
So as I understand what you're saying according to the partnership agreement itself, it's dissolved.
Correct.
And that's already happened because this condition has been met.
Right. Right. Yes, in 17 it says the partnership shall be dissolved upon the occurrence of these following events. And so one of them is there are no more limited partners. So that is.
But the thing that you say has already occurred, I don't, that's in dispute, right? Your opposing counsel would not agree that it has been dissolved.
Well, he used those terms interchangeable, termination, liquidation, dissolution. And as I said, he's throwing our argument as one seeking a judicial dissolution rather than, but obviously my wherefore clause and relief that was granted is that it be liquidated and regardless.
Is it fair to say that your complaint was trying to enforce the partnership agreement?
Yes.
You were not seeking a judicial dissolution under 0802.
That's correct. Let's see. There's one other thing that I feel like I should bring up at this time. I was informed that the general partner did sell the major asset on a closing that was January 31st, 2019, on a contract for deed. It's my understanding it's to an entity, the manager of which is the husband of his secretary.
And that's not in the record, is it?
It's not in the record, and I
was there an attempt to augment the record?
No, Your Honor, no.
So on what ground would we consider that in our analysis?
Well, I only added because it seems that it could be relevant to whether the issue is moot or not, I guess. I don't think it's moot because I think my client still may have additional legal action to take arising out of that, but I just think if the court may look at that differently. So if I'm that's inappropriate, then I apologize.
Well, generally, unless there's some formal inclusion of a piece of evidence in the record, which can be done in some circumstances on appeal, then we All would right. not on the basis of
okay.
of a representation from the
I understand, Your Honor. Sorry. I understand that. Would not normally bring up things that are not in the record. It's kind of an unusual situation. So, So I guess just to summarize, Your Honor, we're asking merely that the effect of the fact that there are no limited partners, that the agreement calls for liquidation, and that the district court order, in effect, does order liquidation, on the assets sold. And we ask that the court retain jurisdiction over the matter to enforce that. So that's basically my argument. So thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schmidt. Yep. Mr. Gabor, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you. Your Honors, I think language is important, and we've all been throwing around a number of words, liquidation, dissolution, termination. I think it's important that we look at what relief was sought, what was granted, and how that relates to our argument. The relief that was sought in respondent's complaint was an order from the district court to wind up the business activities. The district court, in their order, ordered that Nordic be dissolved, not liquidated, dissolved. In the Gale case, the complaint asked for a determination that it had been terminated. And this court in Gale decided that Gale did not have standing to seek that termination because she was not a partner at the time. And that, in essence, is what we are saying here, is that you cannot, as a non-partner, as someone who's just a transferee with a financial interest, and Mr. Schmidt is right when he cited from the statute talking about people with a financial interest are entitled to the net distributions or the net amount from any dissolution. Of course they are, because they have a financial interest. They're not entitled to seek an order from a district court seeking that dissolution. And that's what respondents did here. They sought an order from the court, and so we are saying they sought a judicial dissolution. The statute 0108, by its very name, non-judicial dissolution, implies just that, that the court is not involved. And Judge Johnson, to your point and to your concern about if you don't grant the relief we're seeking, then this partnership could go on in perpetuity. It could. That would be the decision of the partners. If 2025 comes...
General partners, you mean?
General partners. Well, between now and 2025, additional limited partners can be added, additional general partners could be added, and they could decide, or the general partner could decide, hey, this is going well, I want to continue it. We're going to modify the partnership agreement and extend it however we'd like.
Can the general partners modify the agreement without any limited partners joining in that?
The general partners, there would need to be at least one additional general partner. But between now and 2025, that could surely happen. There could be another general partner who would come in to extend it. So to your concern about whether this would go on and the partnership would go on in perpetuity, it might, and it might be just that the partners decide that they're going to continue running the partnership, and that would be up to them to do that. And if they did that, then respondents and people similarly situated would continue to get the benefit of whatever profits that partnership made. But they do not have the right, they do not have standing to come into district court and order or ask for an order dissolving the partnership. They have other remedies that I discussed earlier in my presentation, but they don't have the remedy that the district court granted them here. And if we look at the actual language of the district court, in conclusion of law number 2, they basically say, regarding the issue of standing, the court concludes that there's been nothing presented that the legislature intended that plaintiff's interests be protected. And obviously, our argument is that this was a judicial dissolution. The plaintiff's interest is not to be protected for two reasons. Number one, it says a partner can apply for dissolution, only a partner. Statutory construction says when a statute describes or identifies the people affected by it, in this case partners, there is an implied exclusion of all others, and that would include people with a financial interest. So just to sum up here, respondents did have a remedy. They chose not to pursue the particular remedy they had, basically saying the general partner wasn't following the partnership agreement, and to the extent we suffer damages because of that, we're entitled to recover those damages. What they can't do under the Gale case is seek dissolution of the partnership, and we're asking for a reversal of the district court's order granting dissolution. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel. The case is submitted, and the court will issue its opinion within 90 days. Counsel in the next case, Dexter, may come forward and get ready. The third case.